Okay, so let's get started. So let me ask you a question. Have you ever had an experience of where you're in a situation where you have an obligation for something? Even if it's something that you enjoy, you're not looking to get out of it, and then something out of your control comes along and basically gives you an exemption. You don't have to do it anymore. Have you ever had that experience? I'll give you an example. It happens at least once a year pre-corona, and that is that I have a class in Frederick Wednesday night, this class, and there's a snowstorm. It's out of my control. I know you ascribe a lot of things to me, but that's way above my pay grade. Okay? Not in my wheelhouse. And out of my control, the class is canceled. What's the natural reaction of a person when that happens? Let's be honest here. Come on. When?
Michelle said she's got free time.
Right. Everybody's thrilled. Okay, I don't want to go so far as I'm thrilled, but I'm pretty happy. You know what? I had this exemption. I had this obligation, but I'm thrilled to be off with that. And see, I have free time. I can take care of something else. Good riddance, right? Baruch Hashem. I'm good. I'm really, and I'm not going to get punished for this, right? I'm really off the hook. Yeah, you're completely off the hook. Well, here's where we run into trouble. Because if you look at the source sheet that hopefully you have, I sent it out
Yes.
earlier today.
Oh no.
Uh-oh, someone didn't do their homework.
I didn't get a chance to get it.
Well, in this week's parsha, I'll read it to you. In this week's parsha, we come across a fascinating incident, one that's very similar in the experience that we just talked about.
Leave this one in 5
God
minutes.
tells us. God tells Moshe to tell the Jewish people about the mitzvah of bringing the Pesach offering at its appropriate time. You're supposed to bring it. But the Torah tells us this week that there were some people who were tameh. They were unclean by reason of a corpse. They came in contact with the deceased, and therefore they could not offer the Passover sacrifice on the correct day. Appearing that same day before Moshe and Aaron, these men said, "Well, unclean though we are by reason of a corpse, why must we be left out from presenting the Lord's offering at its set time with the rest of the Israelites?" In simple English, good. I have an exemption because the rule is that to bring an offering, you have to be in a ritually pure state. They were impure through no fault of their own, as we'll see in a moment. And yet, the natural reaction of, "Yes! No Korban Pesach this year. Yes, don't have to do that. No, that was not their response. Their response was just the opposite. And it really begs the question: if the same God that established the rules for bringing the Pesach offering, including the law that somebody impure cannot partake of it, they were blameless. They did nothing wrong. So say, "Thank you. I'll see you next year." That's not the case. Why were they blameless? So if you look at source number two, it tells us, the Talmud tells us, why all of a sudden did these people become impure? So it's brought down in a Braita, that's a Judaic source, that it is written, there were certain men who were impure by the corpse of a person, and they could not observe the Pesach on that day. Who were these people? The Braita answers, they were the bearers of Joseph's coffin, which the Jewish people brought with them in the desert. Remember, Joseph, when he died, he was buried in Egypt, but he made the Jews promise that when the day would come and the Exodus would happen, they were not to leave his remains there. They are to bring it up to the land of Israel, which they did. So you have people who are responsible to take care of the coffin of Joseph. There were these people, and they came. They were 100% involved in a very important mitzvah. Taking care of the deceased is obviously up there and one of the top mitzvot. They were completely blameless in why they were impure. Yet, they complained and they said, "Why should we be different? Why should we be left out from amongst all the other children of Israel?" The same God who said that there should be a mitzvah of a Pesach offering is the same one that said this year you wouldn't have to. Again, I would have had the reaction of, yes. But their response was completely different. That's question number one, to try to understand the message there. But there's a much more fundamental question that we should ask. How do we know this law that we're now, well, let me fill in the blank. So what was God's response? They came to Moshe and Aaron, and they said, why should we be left out? Moshe and Aaron said, it's a great question. We'll be right back. Turn around, have their conversation with God. And the response was very simple. And that is exactly 30 days after Passover. They are to get the opportunity again to bring the Pesach offering. This rule only applied to those who had a legitimate reason to miss Passover number one. If, for example, you were lazy and you procrastinated and you go, oops, I forgot. No, you don't get that second chance a month later. However, people who were impure because of taking care of a mitzvah, or they were on the road traveling and they couldn't get back in time, something again out of their control, they do have the second opportunity, which in Hebrew we call Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach, the second Passover. It only applies to these people. So the question that they ask is, if this is the rule that God laid out, then why didn't God teach those laws of the second Passover immediately when he taught all the laws of Passover? Say, here's the requirement. On the 15th day of Nisan, on the Hebrew month, that's when you're supposed to bring the Passover offering. And here are all the rules, who should and shouldn't, and how to do it, and yada, 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 yada. However, at the very bottom, you know, like in title XV1, Roman numeral 2, and I, like somewhere down there in the subcategory, there should have been, and if you were impure because of something out of your control, or you were on the road, blah, 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 then you get opportunity next month to do the same thing. But yet that's not the case. God only teaches us this law in response to the incident and request from these people. Why would that be? Well, you look perplexed that it's not such a good question, Liz.
Well, no, I think you don't ever want to give an out from the get-go.
Why? Why? This is an honest-to-goodness truth. If God is going to say that this is a legitimate concern of somebody who, out of their control, there is a second opportunity, so why not teach that? Why hold it back? And then if somebody happens to ask, all right, fine, you win. I'll tell you what I had in mind. It seems a weird way to do it.
But I guess I think of it like in school, a teacher might have a plan for makeup exams, but they're not necessarily going to say, the date of the final is this. If you can't make it, I'm going to do the makeup here.
But they all do that. That's on the syllabus. And besides, I think we can give God a little more credit than our college professors. He knows the law. Again, I'm coming from the perspective that God knows that in truth, this is the correct law. It's not something that, oh, good question. Okay, now I rule. Here's a new law. I don't think it evolved that way. If it's true, it's true. So it's strange that God didn't teach it from the outset. But I think you're onto something, because I think there's such a tremendous lesson that's learned from this. And that is one's approach to doing mitzvah. It's an approach to how we look at the perspective we have on doing commandments. Maybe perhaps God intentionally omitted everything or anything about the second Passover in order to teach how we're supposed to view missed opportunities to do a mitzvah, even when it's not your fault. Maybe God is trying to teach us that as compensation for those who really desire to do more than they were obligated, because they weren't obligated at that point, but their desire to want to do that mitzvah was so great, and it expressed an incredible, sincere regret that they had for missing the opportunity, I can't think of a better way than to teach it by showing people who actually do it. You see, if it's just a law in the book, you're right. Then it's just another thing to read, another thing to learn. Okay, if the situation arises, I'll try to remember that's the case. This is so much more profound because it teaches us the fundamental lesson. If you're feeling so, genuinely sad for missing an opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah, you deserve and you're given a second chance. That's a wow, what a great lesson. That's really the fundamentals of what is going on here. You know, as time goes on, I think we all intuitively understand that maybe technologically we are more advanced than previous generations. But in terms of being spiritually attuned and sensitive, our antennas are getting weaker and weaker. And we're losing more and more of that sensitivity as time goes on. The good news is that this is nothing new. This is already recorded in the Talmud 2,000 years ago, of they were bemoaning the fact that in those days, things were falling apart. They were talking about the then-a-days and the nowadays. Take a look at source number 3. It's such a great story. I mean, it's sad, but it reads as follows. The Talmud here discusses and says, look, come and see how the latter generations are not like the earlier generations. In the earlier generations, people would bring their fruit into their courtyard through the main gate in order to obligate themselves in giving a tithe. There's a law. There's something called ma'aser, of taking a tithe, a tenth, right, of what it is that we produce. Well, there's a lot of technical laws as to how, when, in what situation. So the earlier generations, they followed the protocol. You gathered your fruit and you came through the main gate. The minute you came through that gate, that's when an obligation now fell upon you to give a tenth. For example, prior to going through the main gate, if let's say you gathered your crops, but you didn't have a chance to bring them in yet, and all of a sudden a wild group of hyenas comes through and eats up 10 bushels of your produce, you don't have to then say, oh, I guess that's now no longer part of your tithing process. It's not obligated yet. You're allowed to subtract 10 bushels from your total. Then you say, okay, how much is 10% of what's left? But the obligation only begins once you go through the main gate. So the Talmud here says, look at the earlier generations. They would purposely bring it through the main gate. However, the latter generations, they bring their fruits through the roof, through the courtyard, through the enclosed courtyards. They would avoid the main gate in order to exempt themselves from the mitzvah of tithing. Okay, and then the Talmud shows why that rule is. Can you imagine? Yeah, I can imagine it. Who amongst us hasn't heard of stories who people who are constantly looking for, quote, the legal loophole? Oh, come on. Don't shake your head. You don't know what I'm talking about. Even those of you who are, or don't even show me your face, I know you're shaking your head.
Taxi bait.
No question. We all, unfortunately, may be guilty, or we know of enough cases where people play the shtick. People play the game. Well, it only said that if I take taxes off it, well, you know what? If you pay me cash under the table, I won't have to report it to Uncle Sam. Now, that's true. No one's going to ever know, but that's not legal. Technically, any amount you earn, you're supposed to report. But okay, I'm not judging anyone. I'm just saying this is nothing new. This has been around for thousands of years. And the Talmud is bemoaning this fact. It's all about an attitude. How much do you really want to do the mitzvah? The earlier generations, they had no issue. Sure, they thought of the legal loophole, but they said, but that's not the point. The point is that I want to do the mitzvah because that's part of the process of how I become a better person, of how I nurture my relationship with God. I don't want to avoid that. It's an entirely different perspective. You find this in many, many cases. The difference is, think about a poor person, somebody who's legitimately poor, who is exempt from buying things of material worth, yet he's pained. He wants those things, but unfortunately, he doesn't have the funds for it. How much, if he were given the opportunity, all of a sudden he came into some money, yeah, what would he do now? All of those grandiose things of how he would change the world, and he would give this amount to charity, and he would have this cause and that cause, because he's been dreaming this for who knows how long. And then, man, he wins Powerball, $800 million. OMH. Oh my gosh, right? He'd be, yeah. And now all of a sudden he wants to go to Cancun. He needs a bigger house. All the things he had at the top of the list are somehow they keep sliding down. But he has this desire. It's an intense desire to participate in spiritual experiences because you value each and every opportunity to do a mitzvah. These people who were impure were not satisfied to just be exempt from bringing the Pesach offering. They sought new means of how to fulfill it. That's an entirely different approach of how we can look at mitzvot. But let's take it further. I think the person that perhaps exemplifies this in the most profound way is none other than Moshe, Moses. What do we find? I'll give you two situations. Let's talk about, again, how did we take Joseph's coffin out of Egypt in the first place? Where was he buried? The Torah doesn't say. It just says he was buried in Egypt. With a promise, he made them swear that they would take him out. But where? It's unclear. As I said, the Torah doesn't identify specifically where it is. But there was no way that Pharaoh was letting his vice president be buried outside. Can you imagine if one of the leading officials in this country just says, you know what, I want to be buried in Cuba. How's that going to go over? You know, that's a no-no. So clearly, Joseph had to be buried in Egypt. So there's different sources as to, some say that Pharaoh purposely to keep the Jews enslaved and never to leave because he knew that there was a promise that they'll take his bones out when they left. He buried Joseph's coffin deep in the Nile so that they'll never get it. Well, they promised. So if they can't get it, they're never going to leave. They tried all different things. But the Midrash tells us that Moshe was really the original keeper of Joseph's coffin. And the Midrash applies this term. If you look at source number 4, the verse tells us that Moses took with him the bones of Joseph, who had exacted an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "Don't remember, right? Remember, God will be sure to take notice of you. Then you shall carry up my bones from here with you." Moshe is the one who took care of that. Look at this. Source number 5. This is from the Midrash. Come see how beloved God said, how beloved mitzvot were to Moses, because all of Israel busy with the spoils of Egypt. Everybody's running around right before we left, gathering the gold and the silver and all of the loot. But what was Moshe busy with? He occupied himself with mitzvot. As it says, the wise of heart will take commandments, but he that is a fool in his speaking will stumble. Moshe didn't, quote, waste his time gathering the gold and silver. He understood the importance of fulfilling a promise, of doing a mitzvah as was commanded to take Joseph's bones out with him. There's millions all over the place. Moses is not a descendant of Joseph. He's from the tribe of Levi, not Joseph. He's from a different father. Yet he's very busy with all the responsibilities of the Exodus. 2.5-3 million people. He's the leader. He's setting up the system of living. He's preparing them for the giving of the Torah. I would say he's busy. Yet, he understands the importance of taking care of the mitzvah. True understanding of the value of every mitzvah versus that of just material well-being. One example. There's another one. Source number 6. And they brought all the tabernacle to Moses. This is at the very end of the story of where they left Egypt. They've already received the Torah. They've unfortunately already sinned with the golden calf. And then they're given the command to build the tabernacle, to build the Mishkan. And we're told that the craftsmen headed up by Bezalel and Aholiab, two great craftsmen and engineers, they design, they build, everything's going great. And now it's time to actually erect the building itself. And the Torah tells us that what happens here, Rashi explains that the craftsmen themselves were unable to erect it. They couldn't put up the tabernacle. Why? Because since Moses had done no work in the Mishkan itself, because that was not his job, he didn't donate, he didn't build any vessels, He didn't create any beams. None of that was done by Moses. And the Midrash tells us that Moses was bitterly crying. How come I can't have a part of this? Stop. Ask yourself the following question. Moses, enough is enough. You've been God's right-hand man. You're the one who brought the plagues. You've been the messenger to do that. You've been the one to lead us out, split the sea, go up on Mount Sinai, talk to God face to face, come down, teach us the Torah, on and on. Okay. So you don't get one mitzvah. It's not like you don't have a few to go. Yeah. But that's not how Moshe looked at it. Missed opportunities for mitzvah, sincere regret at the lost opportunity. Even if you've got a million already in storage, every one of them is critically valuable. Moshe had that recognition of the value of each and every single mitzvah. I'm going to share with you another insight along the same lines. It's not as rosy a picture. It's actually an unfortunate incident. In Jewish history, there's no dearth of tragic stories of people that were killed just the mere fact for being Jewish or for teaching Torah, depending on which tyranny we were under at what point in history. But there's identified what's known as the Asara Haruge Malchut, the 10 martyrs. There's 10 sages that are identified, and at certain periods, most of which was under the Roman persecution, Rabbi Akiva being one of them. His demise, his untimely death, is gruesome to bear. But there it talks about the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who served as the high priest in the temple. His name is Rabbi Yishmael. Yes, named for, interestingly enough, maybe sometime we'll talk about it, Abraham's son Ishmael. Funny that he should be named for him, but okay. Rabbi Yishmael tells us, I'm sorry, the Talmud tells us that what happened to Rabbi Yishmael is that the tyrant's daughter enjoyed and took great pleasure in what do you call it, in the beauty of Rabbi Yishmael. He was a very handsome individual, and she wanted to preserve his beauty. You'd think that under those circumstances, to preserve his beauty would be a commuting of his sentence of being martyred, of being killed. But that's not how this brutal tyrant worked. He decided that he was going to flay the skin directly off of him so that his beauty could be preserved. His life cares about that. And the Talmud tells us that they're flaying his skin, peeling the skin off of him, and he's quiet until they reach the point on his forehead of where he had been for years, his whole life probably, had placed his tefillin. Tefillin placed on the arm and tefillin placed on the head. And it says that when they reach the place of the tefillin on the head, Savach bekol mar liyotzer nishmato. He cried out bitterly to the maker of his neshama, and he died. One of the great leaders of the previous generation, Rabbi Henoch Leibowitz, asked the question. He says, I understand the concept, but why specifically at that point? Rabbi Yishmael already had been told that this is the fate that he was going to befallen. He was the witness of murder of his closest friend, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. He suffered unbelievable physical pain till that point. Why didn't he cry out before then? Why only at that moment? Says Rabbi Leibowitz, because all of the physical pain and even most of the emotional pain he was able to grasp, he was able to tolerate. But if you're going to take the skin away from where I normally put tefillin and I can no longer do that mitzvah, that I can't bear anymore. That's why he cried out. That ability to understand the pain when he realized the loss of a mitzvah that he couldn't do anymore. This is perhaps a really fundamental lesson that we can all learn from. And if you say, yeah, I get it, but I don't know. Well, let me point you in the direction of one more piece, and then we'll bring it all together. Look at source number 7. Source number 7, I took straight from your Yom Kippur machzor, from your Yom Kippur service. And it's not only from the Maariv service, it's in every one of the Yom Kippur services. At the point of where we start banging our chest and we say, we've done this wrong and we've done this and I'm sorry and I regret this and that and the other. After you finish a certain section, we read the following words. In Hebrew, it's Sarnu mi mitzvotecha mi mishpatecha hatovim velo shavalanu. We have turned away from your commandments and from your good laws, God, and we have gained nothing from it. The simple understanding is that, yes, we messed up. We turned away. And not only that, but now that we look back in hindsight, even from turning away from you, and we thought we did it because we were going to get extra money or extra pleasure or extra whatever, at the end, I can look back and say, honestly, I turned away. And you know what? I didn't gain anything from it anyway. That's the simple understanding. Oy, if only we understood that on that level, that we would be great people. But I read once a beautiful insight that takes it to another level. Perhaps the phrase, and we have gained nothing from it, can be read differently. In English, it doesn't come out as well. But in Hebrew, the words velo shavalanu can be translated literally is that it was not valuable to us. Not we didn't gain, it didn't bring value to us. But you know what? The source of my turning away from you, God, of not grabbing hold of those opportunities, or even when those opportunities came and I rejected them, you know why? At the source, at the most fundamental level, it's because velo shavalanu, it wasn't valuable to us. We didn't give it the value we should have. How much do you really want it? What's your desire? Do you really, really appreciate what it means to be a Jew? Do you really, really, really appreciate what it means to have a relationship with the Creator, the Almighty? Do you appreciate that mitzvot aren't there to make us crazy? They're there to help us. They're here to guide us. When you view it that way, yeah, every now and then you want to throw your hands up and say, really? I get it. But for the most part, if you have an attitude that says, I do understand, I do value all of this, then not only won't you grab as many opportunities that come available, but even when there's a situation that it's unavoidable and you can't do it, you actually have a pang of regret that you can't do it. Like these tremendous individuals who couldn't, and rightfully so, didn't bring the first Passover offering, but their greatest desire was to do it anyway. You can truly achieve everything you want to. You can. You say, but some things are out of my control. If you want it bad enough, you can have it. You say, no, that's not true. I appreciate the sentiment, Rabbi, but it's not true. I can want to be a rich man, but it's not up to me. But it is. It totally is. I came across this last night when I was trying to research this. I had never seen this before. It comes from a great work, source number 8. Source number 8 here is from a book called Duties of the Heart, Chovot HaLevavot, Obligations of the Heart. It's a classic work known as Musar, as self-development. Really, it's a classic work. It's part of a much larger piece. But in it, if you want, you can... Oh, I lost the underline? Do you have anything underlined there? Oh, I'm missing. Where is it? What's the last word in yours on number 8? Is it fulfill? You guys have to get off of mute here. Anybody?
Ours aren't numbered, so I'm counting.
Oh, yours aren't numbered?
Oh.
Oh. I wonder what source sheet I sent you.
No, you sent the right one.
It's the one. Do you see the one that has Duties of the Heart, Eighth Treatise? Maybe it's the last one. Maybe I sent you the wrong one.
No, no, it's number 9.
Is that the last source?
No, there's one after
okay,
it. Good.
Okay, so I must have missed one here somewhere. Okay, the
yeah,
one
the last, Duty... looking for the last word is creator.
Okay, good. So maybe you have the right version. Great.
That's,
is there
that's
anything
the
underlined?
No.
Okay. Okay, so look in source number 8 about 5 lines into it. The sentence begins with the word then.
Yeah.
Yes?
Then, yes. Then whatever.
Then. Okay. He writes, then, whatever one is capable of attaining in practice, he should make diligent efforts in it and exert himself. If you can do it practically, do it. And that which is beyond one's ability to attain in practice, he should attain an understanding of it and desire for it. Listen to his words here. The Chovod Al Vovod here is teaching us such a profound lesson. What you can do in practice, what you can actually do, no excuses. Do it. Give it 110%. And some things you'll say that are out of your ability to accomplish, yeah, maybe in practice. But let me show you, he says. I'm going to let you get the accomplishment without ever doing it. How? Show me you really want it. If you take the time to learn it, understand it, and say, I want it, I really, truly want it, it's yours. In God's mind, it's as if you did it. Classic story. You went to go visit someone in the hospital. Remember those days you can actually do that? You went to go visit someone in the hospital, and the elevator is broken. And you have to schlep up 4 flights of stairs. Oy, I'm schwitzing just thinking about it already. Okay? And you get up there and you're huffing and puffing. And you open up the door and you walk to the nurse's station and you say, I'm sorry, I'm here to see Mr. Smith. What room is he in? The nurse looks, taps on her computer. She says, oh, I'm sorry. He was actually discharged this morning. Are you kidding me? Really? I'm so happy for him. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Do you get credit for visiting the sick? You know, on the one hand, you say, well, it's a nice sentiment, but you didn't. You didn't go visit him. Says the Torah, you do get credit for visiting the sick. Why? Because it was something out of your control and you did everything you could and your desire was to do it. Don't tell me that if I sit in my lounge chair and say, I really do want to go visit Mr. Smith. I really do. But you ain't done diddly to try to make it happen. You didn't even bother picking up a phone or texting him. Then you have no right to claim I wanted to do it.
Right.
It's got to be real. We're talking about sincerity. But if you truly understand and desire, and it's something that you can't physically achieve, it's something that you spiritually think you can't achieve, you can achieve it. If you take the time to learn it, and you take the time to study it, and you build up a certain attitude of, I want this, yeah, then you get credit as if you did it. If you're overcome with a grief that you missed an opportunity to take part in something special, you know, I've talked a few times about what a privilege it was for me twice to be able to go to the Siyum HaShas, that completion of the Talmudic study of 7.5 years. Not that I did it, but I went to the celebration. It was such a privilege. I didn't go this past time. And part of me regrets it. I did regret it, but I didn't have a choice. But I'll be honest, my desire to go wasn't as burning as it should have been. It was something I would have liked to have done. Not, I'm so disappointed. I'm grief-stricken. I'm grief-stricken. I don't have camp this summer. I wasn't grief-stricken. I missed the Siyum HaShas. And that's on me. But that's real. If you really overcome, if the distress of, I wish I could have been part of that, then that's equal to being present. I'll tell you why this idea came to me. Is because, thank God, we are hopefully, please, Hashem, moving in the right direction of things beginning to open up again. And at some point, we are going to go back to shul. We are going to start going back to our synagogues. Ask yourself this question. How much do you really want it? Yeah, lip service is easy. Yeah, I wish I can go to shul. Yeah? And 8 months after being there and you're back in your old familiar routine, let's assume we're done with masks and all that stuff. 2 years from now, are you going to be like, God, I got to get up again for that Saturday morning service? Oh my God. Really? How much do you really want it? What we need to do is to create that attitude of how valuable are these mitzvos to us? How much of a desire do I have to fulfill it? That's the question. And let me finish with this. Let me finish with a story. There's a great story about a student going up to visit the yoga master. And he says, Master, will you be my master, please? The master grabs hold of him, grabs him, and he says, you know, they're very tough. They sometimes, it's been known before now, to even be knifed by some of the masters. Don't run away thinking we're all a bunch of wimps and we just want to coddle everybody. We're not. Needless to say, grabbed hold of the student, he ducked his head down in a tank of water, and he held him there, and he pulled him up, and he said, when your head was underwater, what did you want most? The student looked at him and he said, air, air, master. He says, then you are not ready. When you can honestly say to me that you wanted truth more than air, then you're ready to be my student. For now, you're not ready. Okay, it's an extreme example, but it is so well placed and so poignant as to how much do you want it? Do we value the mitzvos? Do we value the opportunities? Or do we look at it more as an obligation that has a checkbox? Okay, did it. I get one free. Like my kids take a test. There's 11 questions. You only have to do 10. Yes, get a freebie. Is that how we look at mitzvos? Well, thank God there's no temple now because then I'd have 613. Now I only have 260 something. Oh, thank God. Is that how we look at it? Or do we look at them as real opportunities? The word mitzvah, by the way, doesn't only mean commandment. It also means connection because that's what these are. My point here is very simple. And that is, how much do we really want? These people from this week's Torah portion teach us that valuable lesson. That even when you have legitimate excuses, forget when they're not legit, but even when you have legitimate excuses, do you feel a pang of pain that you're disappointed? Do you have a little bit of a regret that you missed the opportunity? Then you're on the right track because that means your heart's in the right place. You desire it. Don't stop. Keep going. You will achieve your goal eventually. That's really the message. How much do you really want it? Questions?
You're not obligated to visit the person who is in the hospital at home to...
You can.
I mean, it's not impossible to fulfill the mitzvah.
That's true, but I'm not off. This was my only day off. The opportunity may or may not present itself, but at that moment, you are given credit as if you did it.
Okay.
I hope that I'll have another opportunity.
Okay.
But it's not like there's only one checkbox that says, I visited Mr. Smith. And if it wasn't Tuesday, so I got one on Thursday. You can get Tuesday and Thursday. They're two separate mitzvah.
Okay. So you get credit for Tuesday if you sincerely tried.
Yeah. That's right. Because your heart is in the right place and you did everything you could. You did it. Again, you can't just say my intentions. You know the expression, right?
Right.
You know, we're all, you know, what's paved with all intentions? Yeah, we're not going there, right? It's a certain road that leads somewhere. Intentions don't mean diddly. You have to do it.
Right.
But to the best of your ability. My point is that what's the next step? Even when you don't have an obligation, view it as a missed opportunity and regret that you lost that chance.
So is there no punishment for the people who don't bring their harvest through the main gate?
Technically, no. It's a legal loophole. Technically, no. Listen, we know in our lives there are things that are right and wrong. But then there's area that's, you know, we use
technically right.
It's either technically right or not technically wrong. That's how I look at it.
Right. Okay.
Not technically wrong. However, you know, there's I won't call it gray area because there's the right thing to do. But there is a space between right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do right, but I didn't do wrong. I avoided the issue. So from a purely legal standpoint, I did nothing wrong. However, that's not the Jewish perspective. What the Torah is trying to do is to train us that that's not appropriate. It may not be technically wrong, but it is inappropriate because it shows a devaluation of a mitzvah.
But isn't the whole Torah more about ethics and morality than it is about legal?
Not at all. Not at all. If that were the case, you know how many, remember, the word for law in Hebrew is halakha. Halakha comes from the word holech, which means to go, walk, travel. This is our path to walk through life. It's not just in my heart. It's not just my intentions. I think Jewishly. I act Jewishly. Judaism is a religion of action, not thought. This is where we are different from Christianity. Christianity at its core is a system of beliefs. Judaism is a system of actions. Yeah, you got to have beliefs too. But at the end of the day, a Jew wakes up in the morning, he's already, before he's opened one eye, he's already got a list of things he's got to do. And it ain't a honey-do list. A Christian wakes up in the morning and just has to believe. That's his work for the day. Jews are actions. Yes, obviously, ethics play a very big role as to determining right and wrong, what I should do and what I shouldn't do. And I'm not limiting it to just the technical law, but I'm not going to let that go and just say it's only the perspectives. It's only the ethical views. No, it's got to translate into action too.
Okay.
We're up against the clock. Quickly, yeah.
All right, so kind of touching on what Liz says, so there's no punishment for going around the gate and gets because it's a legal loophole. So there's not any real punishment, but however, there's somebody watching all the time.
Correct.
Keeping track of that.
That's correct. But again, is God going to throw one extra thing on the Barbie for you, you know, down below? You know, throw one more stick on there. I don't think so. I mean, it's not a technical wrong, but
Your bar would still be white. It wouldn't be a little bit shaded if that's how you did
question.
It.
I don't know. I don't know if it doesn't have any bit of gray on it. I don't know. That's a good question because I would say like this. I would bet that the guy who's skirting the law, constantly legal loopholes, is going to cross that line eventually.
Right. It's not only, his first time.
It's only a matter of time.
So he might not get gray for that, but he's living a grayish life.
And he's ultimately going to end up with seriously black because that's the nature of people. You can only skate on thin ice for a period of time. At some point, you're going to fall in.
Okay.
So if you live your life on that edge, you're going to get burned.
Okay.
But maybe not dinged for that action, but it's going to lead down the path of.
Right. The gray path.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
All right. We good? All right.
Excellent.
Very good. Have a great evening, everyone.